Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. On this edition of Michigan Writers on the Air, I'll be talking to author Lynn Ray Perkins about her new book, Secret Sisters of the Salty Sea. Then historian and educator David Harris will be here to share the story of a writing project that represents more than 40 years of work and continues on. Anne-Marie Oman will also stop by to tell us about her role as an editor. And at the end, Fleeta Brown will provide an audio essay on poet James Lenfesti. I'm delighted to welcome Lynn Ray Perkins to Michigan Writers on the Air. And first I'm going to read a couple of sentences from your bio at the beginning of your blog. And the future was bright. Something was bound to happen. And something has happened. You're at 14 or 15, something like that?
Something like that. I have to count them on my fingers every time I have to answer that question.
And included on the list is Crisscross, which won the 2006 Newbery Medal. Your books cover such a range of topics. Some are children's books. Some are sort of what later?
YA.
Young adult.
Teen, mid-teen.
Mid-teen. No adult novels yet, but that's probably coming at some point.
Actually, the next thing I'm going to work on, I'm not really clear where it's going to fall. When I first started working on it, I thought it would be an adult novel. And it might still. It might be sort of a crossover between teens and adults.
As a reader, like them all. I mean, I like the children's books. I like the young adult. I especially admire As Easy as Falling Off the Face of the Earth. I mean, the idea of taking a teenager out there, taking his phone away and setting him free. He has to find life without his phone.
Well, that was one of the quandaries when I was writing that book, is I was thinking about how hard it is to have an adventure when you have your phone, because, you know,
everyone's looking down.
Well, yeah. But also help is just a couple of clicks away.
Exactly.
So if you can't, how do you arrange a story so you can't do that?
So this book, Secret Sisters of the Salty Sea, where did this come from?
A number of years ago, I was talking to my editor, and I'll tell you a little story. When I was in third grade, there were two sections of third grade in my elementary school, and the teachers were preparing the third grade part of the Christmas program. And it involved us reciting 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, and different people had different parts, and probably somebody was acting it out. Probably Victor McQuestion was Santa Claus. But I was a good memorizer, so I had an entire verse to myself. And then I was sick for a few days. And when I came back, because they didn't know if I would be back in time, they had given my verse to these two boys in the other section. And they said, well, it's not really fair that these boys memorized this and don't get to say it, so all three of you will say it together. I thought this was a fate worse than death, to have to recite my verse with these two boys who I didn't even know, who weren't even in my class. And so the night before the program, I prayed as hard as I could that I would be sick the next day so that I wouldn't have to do that. And I woke up and I had an earache. Merry Christmas. And so I was telling my editor this story, and she said, and I said, I'd like to write a little book of stories called Stories with Unclear Morals. Mm-hmm. And she said, we would publish that book. So that's kind of where it started, because I was thinking of these little stories from my childhood that didn't really wrap up that neatly. And one of them was the story in this book where the main character, one night she has a bad dream and she cries out in her sleep. And her parents come and, you know, comfort her, and she really likes that. And so the next night she wakes up in the middle of the night and decides to scream again so that her parents will come again. And that was something that happened in my childhood. So that was, I was just thinking of a couple of other of these stories, and I started writing about them. I didn't really know where it would go at that point.
So the book itself, in adult literature, we'd say it was a road book.
This book?
Yeah.
Well, part of it's on the road.
Yeah, a lot of it's on the road.
Eyjafjallajökull, that means as easy as falling off the face of the earth. That's a road book.
That's a road book. Yeah. This one is a road book of sorts.
I suppose.
Okay. Do you want to talk about some of the things that happened? You know, I mean, for me, it just brought back so many memories.
Well, I mean, I always find it, some of the things that happen are things that are based on things that happened when I was a child. And some of them are made up things, of course. But I just think it's interesting. There's a part where the parents go to a casino on the last night of the vacation and spend all their money. And so the next day, they have three flat tires and are kind of getting a little concerned about the money part. And that is something that happened in my childhood. I didn't know about it till I was, I mean, I knew we had three flat tires, but I didn't know my parents had blown their money at the casino the night before. And I think one thing I'm interested in when I write books for kids is presenting experiences that kids have that aren't talked about a lot. Like, a lot of kids' parents go to the casino. A lot of kids' parents have money troubles. And those things, I think, get glossed over sometimes in books for younger readers. But it's still happening in their lives. And it doesn't mean, you know, that they can't still have a loving family.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess some of those ideas.
And leaving home and going to a new place, which isn't quite that different, but is very different.
Mm-hmm.
New adventures,
mm-hmm.
experiencing new foods, making new friends,
mm-hmm.
staying at a place that isn't home or a relative's home.
Especially if that's not something you've done before.
Yeah. Exactly. And then the ocean itself is so magical if you don't happen to live near water.
Mm-hmm. So my family went to the Jersey Shore when I was growing up for a number of years, and we went to different shores after that. But living in Michigan, it was hard to convince my husband, who was a Michigan boy, that there was a reason to go to the ocean because we have Lake Michigan. But I felt I needed to refresh my memory, so we did a trip to Cape May, New Jersey, so that I could remember what it was like. And it was really different. I mean, in some ways, Lake Michigan I like so much better because you can go to Good Harbor Bay, walk for 5 minutes, and have the place to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And in New Jersey, that is very hard to find.
It's New York moving on to the beach.
Right, exactly. But in other ways, the ocean itself is just so wonderful.
It's the sound, the smell.
Right, and the constant waves.
Yeah.
Never stopping, yeah.
So would you like to read some of this book?
I was thinking I might read that part I described a few minutes ago. It's in two parts, the part where she actually does have the bad dream and then the next part where she pretends to.
Oh, that'd be terrific.
Okay. This chapter is called A Perfect Moment. Alex ran from the giant bug. Not the one from before. This was another giant bug. This one was shiny, black-brown like the first one, but even bigger. It was as big as a small bird, and it wasn't accidentally bumping into her. It was chasing her on purpose. She could tell. It made a loud buzzing noise, and it clicked in an evil, horrible way. She raced to the screen door and pulled on the handle, but it wouldn't open. Was it locked? She pushed in the button and yanked. The rickety door held fast. She called out for her mother. She yelled for her dad. Where in the world was everyone? She bellowed for Jules. No one answered. No one came. The immense insect landed on her arm. Alex tried to shake it off, but it sank its sharp pincers deep into her skin and hung on. It hurt. She screamed. And then she was sitting up in bed, and her mom's arms were around her, holding her close. Her dad was there, too, with his arms around both of them. It was nighttime. You were dreaming, honey pie, he said. What was it? Do you remember? I have dreams, too, mumbled Jules from the other bed, but I don't wake everybody up in the middle of the night. Go back to sleep, Jules, said their mom. She brushed Alex's hair from her face. She kissed her forehead. You're okay, she said. Everything is okay. It was a bug, said Alex, a really, really big bug, bigger than the other one. It was eating my arm.
Shh, said her mom.
Lie back down. Think about kittens, furry little kittens, and puppies. She tucked the covers in around Alex's shoulders.
I'll stay here until you fall asleep, she said.
Alex snuggled up to her like a puppy or a kitten.
Can we get a kitten, she asked.
No, said her mother. They grow up to be cats.
I'm going back to bed, said her dad. Nighty-night.
An ocean breeze floated through the room, salty and wild. It carried the faint shush of the crashing waves. Bright moonlight threw leafy shadows on the bare floor. They did not have moonlight this bright at home. Alex reached a hand out of her cocoon and made a shadow in the shape of a snapping goose. I will treasure this moment always, she said. Her mother laughed. She stood up and pulled the curtains together, then sat back down on the bed.
Me too, honey pie, she said. Now close your eyes.
Alex closed her eyes, and the perfect moment melted softly, invisibly, into a perfect sleep.
So then the next day happens, and she goes on a very long walk with her dad, which explains the first sentence.
Maybe it was because of the very long walk that Alex fell asleep right after dinner. She didn't even remember putting on her nightgown and getting into bed, but there she was. She woke up as moonlight found an opening in the curtains and lit up the floor beside her bed. The leafy shadows wobbled. She heard Jules breathing, a soft, small sound, and the muffled crashing of the waves. Breakers, her dad had called them. It was the middle of the night. It felt so strange to be so awake, alone, the only one. Alex wished she could snuggle up to her mother like she had the night before. But she was too big to wake her mother up for no reason, and there was no reason. No good reason. She almost wished she could have another bad dream. She closed her eyes and thought about giant beetles and tried to feel afraid, but nothing happened. She opened her eyes again to the silently wobbly moon shadows. She put her hand out into the light and made a goose. Then she had an idea. Before she knew it, she had let out a small shriek, and then a medium-sized, no! And then a full-throttle, blood-curdling wail. Jules raised herself up on her elbows and looked at her.
Are you going to do this every night? She asked.
Alex was taking a big breath for the next one when she heard footsteps thumping closer. Her dad's footsteps. He stopped in the doorway when he saw her sitting up in bed.
Are you all in one piece? He asked.
Where's Mom?
Asked Alex.
Oh, said her dad. I see. He sat down on the side of her bed. Jules lay back down and pulled her pillow over her head.
So, another bad dream? Dad asked.
Oh, said Alex. Yeah, it was pretty terrible.
What happened? Asked her dad.
Alex hadn't thought about that.
I don't know, she said. I don't remember exactly. Something scary, though. I think I was running.
She leaned into her dad's chest. His T-shirt smelled daddish. He put his arm around Alex and patted her back.
Are you okay now? He asked.
Yes, she said, sitting back up.
Good, he said.
He tucked her in and kissed her on the forehead.
Nighty-night, then.
Me too, said Jules. So he tucked Jules in and kissed her forehead, too. Then he shuffled out of the room, yawning.
Alex still did not feel sleepy.
Are you awake, Jules? She whispered.
Kind of, mumbled Jules.
I didn't have a bad dream, said Alex.
What? Said Jules.
I made it up, said Alex.
Why? Asked Jules.
I wanted Mom to come sit with me again, said Alex. I felt lonely.
Oh, said Jules, you can always crawl in with me.
Really? Said Alex.
Sure, said Jules. Come on over.
She lifted up her blanket and made room. Alex slipped through the column of moonlight and crawled in. They curled together like spoons, snug as two bugs in a rug. Not pinchy bugs, nice bugs, the nicest bugs ever.
Lynn Ray Perkins reading from Secret Sisters of the Salty Sea. You write the material and you illustrate the material. This is the chicken and egg question.
Which comes first? They go back and forth a lot. I'm sure every writer does, but I rewrite a lot. So, sometimes I do drawings between writings. Sometimes I do the drawing first and it helps me think what the story is because I just start with an image. And then sometimes when I'm working on the story, something visual comes to mind. So I remember talking about this with Glenn Wolfe, and he said that when he is having trouble with his drawing, he plays bass, and when he's having trouble with his music, he draws. And I think it's nice to have two things.
So this book is essentially designed for what age group?
I would say 7 to 11, but for me, 8 through 10 is really the target audience.
And I know parents and grandparents will enjoy it also. So what are you working on now?
I just finished a picture book, which will come out in 2019. It's called Winter Cake, and it has three creatures in it. It's also kind of a road book. It's got some traveling. It has a journey.
A journey book.
Yes, a journey book.
If listeners want to find out more information about you and your work, they can go to your blog, which you have consistently kept going.
I've fallen a little.
But I
love doing my blog. I just have not had time lately. But I hope to be regular again. I love doing it because most of the things that I do take at least a year, often a year and a half. And my parameter I set for myself for my blog is to do something that I can do in 2 days. So I love just doing an image and some writing that doesn't have to be a full-length production, just a little snippet.
And is there another place they can find your schedule or stores or libraries you might be?
I guess you could follow me on Facebook because I do post when I'm going to do something there.
And your publisher also has information on,
right,
on your current work. Well, Lynn Ray, I see you about every 4 years, and I hope we'll be able to do this again in the not-too-distant future.
I always enjoy it.
Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. Good to see you.
Good seeing you. I am pleased to welcome David Harris to Michigan Writers on the Air. Today, David will be sharing with us a 40-something year journey on a book that continues to evolve. That journey started when he was a young high school teacher and has continued on after his retirement as a professor of education at the University of Michigan. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Aaron. It's an honor to be here on Michigan Writers on the Air. And in the name of full disclosure, it's a true pleasure to be working with you again, something I haven't done for several decades, back when we were consultants for the Oakland Intermediate School District, you for English Language Arts and I for Social Studies.
David, I often talk to writers that spend 3, 4, 5, sometimes more years on a project. But this work, which is a textbook or a supplementary textbook, Reasoning and Democratic Values, has spanned your entire career, and you continue to work on it and refine it.
That's true. It goes back to my earliest days as a high school teacher in Madison, Wisconsin. I remember in particular one lesson I was trying to teach. It was about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. It was a young ninth grade U.S. history students. And the question that I put to them was, should Senator Edmund Ross of Kansas have cast his vote not to impeach the president? Senator Ross's vote was the deciding vote in the matter. And because he voted not to impeach the president wasn't removed from office. Anyhow, I asked the question, should Senator Ross have voted to impeach the president and remove him from office? And no response. So I was a little bit disheartened. I waited. And then one student finally raised his hand, and he said, when are we going to learn something in this class? And I said, like, what would you like to learn? And he said, last year, Mr. Watson taught us all the presidents. And I said, who came after Benjamin Harrison? He said, I don't know him that way. I only know him in order. Crestfallen, I continued with the lesson, but I realized I didn't know what to do when approaching value questions, judgments by students of ought. And so soon after that, I returned to the University of Wisconsin, where there were some very prominent scholars who had studied this. In particular, they were students of Lawrence Kohlberg at Harvard, who had put forth the theory of the development of ethical reasoning. And having just arrived on the faculty, both of them, I felt it was a real opportunity for me to explore how I could integrate the teaching of American history with the development of moral reasoning by young people in the name of civic education that embraced questions of value.
And you were influenced by Jean Piaget.
That is true. In fact, it was more Kohlberg than I who was influenced by Piaget. Dewey started this business of a moral citizenry. John Dewey, the education philosopher, who, by the way, also once taught at the University of Michigan. And he was arguing persuasively that a moral citizenry required citizens who made ethical judgments through reflection, not simply through impulse or habit. Influenced by Dewey and Piaget, Kohlberg developed his six-stage theory of ethical development. Piaget, Swiss psychologist, published a book in 1932 entitled The Moral Judgment of the Child. And in it, he reports on his brilliant creative research with young children. Let me digress for a moment to explain what it is that he was doing. He created some stories, and he would tell them to young children, and then he would ask them to make judgments. For example, he would tell the child a story about a young girl named Nicole who lived with her mother in a Swiss village, alone, the two of them. And one night, Nicole, who had been told to stop stealing cookies from the cookie jar by her mother and who had promised that she wouldn't do it anymore, snuck into the kitchen, reached for a cookie from the jar, and knocked a cup off the counter, which shattered on the floor. Then there was another girl that Piaget told about. Her name was Françoise, and she also lived with her mother in a Swiss village. And one day her mother was ill, so Françoise attempted to set the table for dinner to help her mother out. And in the process, she knocked six cups off the countertop. They shattered on the kitchen floor. Piaget would then ask the child, who was naughtier, Nicole or Françoise? And typically, the younger children would say that Françoise was naughtier. And he, always seeking the reasoning behind their thinking, asked why. And they would typically say, because she broke six cups. When the children got older, roughly older than five or six, they started to switch. He would ask them who was naughtier, Nicole or Françoise. And the children would reply, Nicole was naughtier. And he would say, why? And they would say, because she broke a promise to her mother and she was doing something she knew was wrong. And so Piaget concludes from this that as children get older, their reasoning becomes more differentiated, more integrated. Clearly, in this case, they take into account not only the consequences of an action when making a judgment, but also the intentions of the actor. So the older kids considered not only the volume of cups that were broken, but what it is that the actor was attempting to do, their motivation. Kohlberg, of course, builds on this idea, influenced also by Dewey, and he creates this six-stage theory of the development of moral judgment.
And you've worked from that and created this series of units, which is now in its second edition. I think there are 39 units. And this is a supplementary text. What's meant by that?
You're right. The title of the work, and it's in two volumes, Reasoning with Democratic Values. There's also an instructor's manual that's available as an e-book. And it is the second edition. The first edition was published in 1985. I wrote it with co-author Alan Lockwood of the University of Wisconsin. Since then, I have been thinking about its contents. The current second edition, just recently published, has, as you say, 39 chapters. evenly divided between the two volumes. They're chronologically ordered, but each chapter stands alone. Our primary audience is secondary students of American history, as well as college students in American history courses. But we've learned through field testing that the chapters are highly engaging to older adults as well. We found that they were highly responsive in reading groups, for example. So each chapter revolves around an ethical issue. We hope that students will engage in not only reasoning about the ethical issue, but enriching their knowledge of American history. So each chapter focuses on a question faced by some individual in the American past, someone who had to decide what to do. For example, should Robert E. Lee have accepted command of the Union armies when they were offered? Should President Woodrow Wilson have urged Congress to declare war to begin American participation in the First World War? Should, to use a Michigan example of one of the chapters, should Governor Frank Murphy in 1937 have used force to evict the sit-down strikers at the General Motors plant in Flint, Michigan? So although each story revolves around a should question, an ethical issue, as we say, that issue is set up in a deep and what we hope is a rich historical context.
Now, you begin each one of these with an episode, which is a narrative, a story, and it's a great story. I mean, these are just compelling. I started reading them several days ago, and you just get hooked into the story itself because it drives forward with so much power. Would you talk about that and then how the units are organized?
Sure. After the publication of the first edition, I thought, well, maybe someday a second edition will be written. So I started to take notes whenever I encountered something that seemed like it might become a good chapter, a good ethical issue. And I would do that when I was reading newspapers and magazines, books, even if I saw an idea in a motion picture, in a film sometimes. And I would keep those notes in a file cabinet. By the time we were ready, and I have two co-authors with this publication, Annalisa Halverson, who's a professor at Michigan State University, and Paul Dane, a retired social studies teacher at Andover High School in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Anyhow, when we met and made selections about the 39 chapters to appear in the new edition, we had hundreds of choices to consider based on what was in those file cabinets. And so we narrowed them down to 39, and we had some criteria that we used. What are the different democratic values involved? How engaging would the narrative that you've just mentioned be to young people? Different kinds of history, political history, social history, economic history, even military history. So we put those all together into the new volumes. Each chapter, as I mentioned a couple of times, revolves around one of these ethical issues, but there are also other learning activities embedded and elaborated in the instructor's manual that help teachers to guide students in understanding American history.
So let's take an example of one of those units. Perhaps you could even read a page or two from the narrative.
Surely. Let me read a little bit from a chapter called The Blame and Shame of It that pertains to the famous Salem witch trials. The infamous episode of madness in Massachusetts came to a close more than 16 months after it had begun. In Salem, the death toll was 25, 19 people hanged, 14 of them women, one man tortured to death, and five who died in prison. One of the judges, Samuel Sewell, served for the entire term of the special court. Sewell was born in England in 1652, moved to Massachusetts with his parents when he was 9 years old. He spent 6 years and earned 2 degrees at Harvard College studying for the ministry. He was a devoutly religious Puritan. He lived his daily life in strict accordance with his faith in the Bible. On the Sabbath, from sundown Saturday until sundown Sunday, he attended public worship with his family, foregoing all work, recreation, and frivolity. Devout families like the Sewells regularly observed silence during scripture study at home. As one of the judges of the special court for witchcraft, Sewell sentenced many to death. He attended some of the hangings. For example, he stood by with townspeople as Sarah Good, whose recent pregnancy had ended with a stillbirth when she was in jail, climbed the ladder to the gallows. He saw the hangman place the rope around her neck and listened to her last words, called out to her accuser in the crowd, "I am no more a witch than you are a wizard." Judge Sewell's conscience, however, was burdened. Many years after the special court was disbanded, he felt guilty about the role as a judge during the witchcraft trials and wanted to repent for what he now thought was his sins. He sought to be reconciled with God for condemning those accused of witchcraft. He still believed that witches were real and in league with Satan, but he thought many of those accused had been innocent. On a Sunday morning in January 1697, the congregation of the Third Church of Boston was greeted with an extraordinary confession of guilt. The minister gave way to Judge Sewell, who had prepared a statement of repentance for his part in the Salem Witchcraft Special Court. In the judge's statement, made openly that day in church, he desired to, quote, "take the blame and shame of it," and ask that both God and men pardon his sin. Around this time, Sewell began wearing sackcloth, a biblical symbol of penance. He realized the true repentance was not momentary. It would be a long process of many steps, including contrition, confession, compensation to those wronged, and a change of heart. Guided by his ardent faith, he was determined to take all these steps. Samuel Sewell also decided to attack slavery at its foundation. He wrote in 1700 that all men have equal right into liberty and all other outward comforts of life. He also wrote an essay in which he addressed, quote, "the right of women," a most unusual phrase in the early 18th century. Samuel Sewell authored America's first anti-slavery tract, which set him at odds with every other prominent man of his time. He portrayed Native Americans not as savages, the standard view of his time among colonists, but as worthy of the grace of God. In a period when women were widely considered inferior to men, he wrote an essay affirming the fundamental equality of the sexes. He was, and would always be, a Salem witch judge. Yet, he acknowledged his misjudgment and never ceased his efforts to make amends.
Engaging story. You move from that to a series of things that the teacher can select that helps them move through the facts of the case, the historical understanding, working on reasoning, writing, speaking. Would you speak to that part of the...
Surely. There's a set of learning activities, the same set for following each chapter. As you say, the first activity is a set of questions that simply ask students to recall the important facts of the chapter. Then the next learning activity asks students to think more deeply about the historical context in which this story takes place, so that they have a richer understanding of what was going on at the time. For example, some deeper understanding of who the Puritans were, why they were here, what they believed. Then there is a section called Key Concepts in American History, where we try to build students' understanding of a deep idea. For example, in this story, a key concept would be establishment of religion. And of course, as I mentioned a couple of times, the main focus of the chapter is for students to reason about the ethical issue. The issue in this case is simple. Should Samuel Sewell, Judge Sewell, be forgiven for his role in the Salem witch trials? And the teacher is encouraged to lead the discussion, not to take a position, certainly not to indoctrinate children, but to help them reason through the issue, taking into account fundamental values, unifying values of, you could say, the American creed, the value of life, for example, in this story. Other values include equality, promise-keeping, truth, the common good. We have a set of them, each defined in the books. In any case, once students get deeply involved in the discussion, teacher-led discussion often, not exclusively, they are asked to consider when, more generally, someone should be forgiven. Can someone who is not contrite be forgiven? Is forgiveness even possible absent contrition? Should Judge Sewell's behavior after his conduct as a witchcraft judge be considered in deciding whether or not to forgive him? And ideally, the teacher engages students in not only reflection, but active discussion with each other, where they probe each other's reasoning together. So really, the underlying goal is twofold. One, to develop their ethical reasoning. We know from the research that's been done about this that when teachers conduct these discussions, students move from the lower stages of ethical reasoning where they're concerned about fear of punishment, self-interest, to the middle stages, sometimes called the conventional stages, where they're concerned about local norms, family approval, group approval, rules in society, to the higher stages, which Kohlberg calls principled stages, where they're concerned about the rights of individuals, the social compact, and ideally at his highest stage, what he calls the universal principles, the general idea that people ought to be treated as ends in themselves and not means to other ends. So one of the purposes of having the discussion is to advance students' ethical reasoning, and another is to enrich their understanding of American history.
So if listeners want to get more information on this book, they can go where?
They can contact Teachers College Press of Columbia University in New York City, and they can go online. We have created a website to support the use of the book, and that would be at www.rdv2.org. Again, www.rdv2.org. There are excerpts there from the teacher's manual. There's information about obtaining copies of the books, including the instructor's manual, which is available only as an ebook. And for those who might be interested, there are two sample chapters at the website. One is about John Brown, and the other one is about two Michiganians who burglarized an FBI office in 1971.
That is a very special story. So the RDV hooks up with the title of the book, which is?
Reasoning with Democratic Values 2.0, to indicate the second edition. Subtitle, Ethical Issues in American History.
David, I'm so glad our paths continue to cross. Thank you for being here.
It's a real pleasure, Aaron. Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on Interlochen Public Radio. An old friend of this program is here. Welcome, Anne-Marie Oman.
Thank you.
Anne-Marie, you are so enormously productive and produce wonderful work in so many genres, poetry, memoir, drama, nonfiction and also some young adult fiction now. Uh-huh. But today you're here in an entirely new role, editor.
Well, actually, this is something I'm returning to. My very, very first publication was Reflections on the 20th Century, which was an editing project. Ah. It was an anthology, too. The very first thing out of the gate. So this is actually a return to something that I loved doing. And I'm so grateful to have this opportunity. Wayne State University Press invited me to do this. And it's just really fun. It's been a thrill. And I'm so proud of it.
And the book is titled?
Elemental, a collection of Michigan nonfiction.
Ah.
Michigan creative nonfiction, yes.
So this creative nonfiction, genres slowly evolve or not so slowly evolve. What does this mean?
Well, creative nonfiction it's an umbrella term that actually encompasses everything from immersion journalism to the lyric essay, which is almost like a prose poem. And so there's all these subgenres that are included under this term. But essentially what it means is that a writer uses fictional techniques, in other words, creative techniques, creative writing technique or style, in order to communicate a true story. So overlaying the story is not just straight journalism. They're using dialogue and character building and setting and all the things that the fiction writer turns to build a narrative in a beautiful way, and using that in such a way that it enlivens the tale the true tale that's being told.
So they're able to adjust the presentation in a way that a narrative writer, fiction writer, would.
Right, and it makes it more accessible to the reader and often creates enough suspense and tension that you just keep going with the reading, and that's a delight.
So what makes this anthology so special?
Oh, where do I begin? First of all, it was a journey for me because what I asked myself when I was invited to do this was, what makes Michigan literature? You know, what is a Michigan, or maybe a little broader, what makes a Great Lakes literature? And I was excited by that question because I thought, is there something like, you know, Southern Gothic or Western, you know, that marks us, you know, that readers can look at and say, oh, that's a Michigan piece. And it took a long time. I was really exploring a lot of different ways into that question, and kept coming back to the old Greek idea of air, earth, water, and fire. And because Michigan is so complicated, its literature is complicated. It's complex. We have, you know, the Upper Peninsula. We have Detroit auto industry. We have this huge agricultural community. We have coastal communities. So we are an enormous macrocosm of multiple forces. But when I looked at it through that old lens, I could see that there was something happening in terms of that's a way to bring it together, those elements and that unity. And ultimately, I think it leads to what I end up with is a kind of transfer, not just survival, which is often a mark of Michigan literature, but survival toward transformation through those elements.
So as the editor, how did you recruit the writers and how did you select the pieces?
Whoa. Well, we made an enormous list and of many, many, many writers. We wanted, of course, a mix. We wanted to be very inclusive. We wanted people from downstate, from the UP, from northern Michigan. And it was a very organic process of making a smaller list with those considerations, then creating invitations to people to submit, and then again reviewing those submissions in light of what we were thinking about as a Michigan literature. So it was a very thoughtful and demanding process. It is certainly not a comprehensive collection. There, you know, you won't find everybody who's writing creative nonfiction, but you will find a broad representation.
So give us a few names.
Teresa Scollin, Rochelle Riley, Ben Bush, Jamie Delp, Jerry Dennis. Where do I?
You go on and on.
They're just beautiful names when you think, you know, everybody should be going, oh, ha, ha, yeah.
And the essays. Can you give us a hint at some of them?
Well, there's an enormous range. And again, I was trying to get to this idea of what brings us toward those elements. You know, I was thinking about that deeply as I went through it. Most of them involve, I'm going to go back to the elements again, earth, air, water, fire. Water was the huge pull, the first huge pull for this. And in part because I think we're a peninsula. So that unites us and isolates us. And so I was looking first for that element of fluidity, not just represented in, you know, Great Lakes writing, but in water writing, but in the sense of fluidity, the sense of being of a peninsula surrounded by water. So that was sort of the first moment of what it's about. A spirit, an energy, a focus toward earth, a sense of vitality, even in the urban pieces, and there are many urban pieces, a sense of vitality about humanity. Those were the things that I was touching on and looking for, and I think are reflected beautifully.
And you have a piece of it to read.
I do. I selected a piece from Teresa Scollin's beautiful piece, Earth. It's called Earth. And it's just, it gets to that spirit that I was speaking of. To live among fields does something to a person. To live along a river or on the Great Lakes does something to a person. People from other parts of the country don't believe the size of the Great Lakes until they arrive, and then they exclaim, "It's like an ocean." We know. We think we told you. More than once, a friend from somewhere else told me my hometown was in the middle of nowhere, an idea I could not understand. It was a blind thing to say, when all around us the earth lay open and alive, dwarfing us. Even under snow, the curves of the world were voluptuous and riveting. It would be like saying, as you lie touching the body of your lover, that you are nowhere. You are at the center. Look out over an expanse, the prairies or the lakes or the curve along M81, and feel a low, slow stirring like timpani, felt rather than heard at the edges of perception, and then a swelling, an ache. Isn't this feeling a cousin to desire, the feeling that it is impossible to take it all in, that the senses are at last fully employed, stretching to contain an otherness, a reaching for what can never be mine? We never speak of it. I don't know if anyone else feels this way, but I think they do. It is the love of ground, which is like love everywhere, molecular and unbidden.
Oh, thank you, Anne-Marie. You read so beautifully. If listeners want more information, they should start with Wayne State University Press.
Wayne State University Press. It will be out in November, and it'll be in the bookstores, and there will be several launches occurring. And so Wayne State will be posting that under Elemental on their website.
And will you be posting any of that on?
Of course, on my Facebook page.
Absolutely.
And this usual social media, yes.
And the book will be available locally and
across all the bookstores, yes.
And all the bookstores.
Yes.
Anne-Marie, it's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's so much fun, Aaron. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Fleeta Brown is here. Welcome, Fleeta.
Hi, Aaron.
And this time you're talking about poet
James Linfesty, Linfesty, Linfesty. Jim lives in Minneapolis, but he and his wife have a summer place on Mackinac Island where he teaches a workshop and invites writers in sometimes. Apparently, it's a pretty lively enterprise. He has other books besides the one I want to talk about. I met his work when I read a book called Seeking the Cave, A Pilgrimage to Cold Mountain, which was a story of his trip to China with several other people to find a cave where the hermit poet Cold Mountain, or Han Shan, lived. Well, I was just fascinated by that book, and I very much enjoyed reading it. So we had coffee one morning, and he told me about this book that was coming up. It's called, the one I want to talk about is called A Marriage Book, 50 Years of Poems from a Marriage. Now, all this time he's been writing other things, but he's been collecting these 50 years of poems from a marriage. It's a full story of a marriage from courtship through children and grandchildren. A reviewer called it a talking photo album or an unfolding epithalamium. The poems in his marriage collection are strongly influenced by the poems of A Cold Mountain. They're very image-driven. They're mostly short, plain-spoken, and just plain charming. Here's his prologue poem. It's called Who Would Believe? Even a good poet must be wary as a spider offering a book of love poems to the woman he married 50 years ago. If he exaggerates his love, she'll know. If he denies it, she'll devour him while remembering her old dead lovers. If he sands off the edge of his desire, what's the point? And if his desire for her is undiminished, who would believe? That's the kind of poem this book offers. There are three sections. The first is really sexy. The second has poems of children as they grow. And the third is called And Still She Blooms. You get the idea. I'm sure our listeners' ears picked up at the sexy reference, so I'll read you one of those poems. This one is called To Make a Baby. These days it takes courage. No one has enough money. Nobody has enough time. No way is there enough room in the house. So you find yourself crowded into that double bed, and the kids are asleep, the checkbook's downstairs. You bump into something warm, and you find your courage rising. So, okay, and then the babies. There are a number of poems about a father coping with new children. This is the opening of one, and there's a crying child, and the father is describing the crying child, just a little piece. Look at him, maniac, sweating in his straitjacket, a scalded prune, ancient projectile, unused warhead, sneaky prototype. A lot of the poems have that kind of wry, self-deprecating humor with the father coping. The children grow up in these poems. That's what makes them unusual. The book is a whole history. You see a preemie and an incubator, a child learning to speak, an eighth grade graduation, a driving lesson, a daughter in college who's taken an overdose, who goes on to have a rich life, a 21-year-old funny son with his own anxieties. We see dangers, risks, and survival. Here's one poem from its middle section. It's called Prayer. I left my daughter alone, like a sheep left along with a pacing moon. I walked the mile to my hotel from her college room with barbed wire stretched through my back. I lay in my bed, an old shepherd, exhausted with tending, stomach sick with the taste of bad water. Even through thick walls, I could hear the howling deep inside her head, see her shy reflection in the water. She huddled alone in moon shadow against the stares of her own eyes, pitiless and knife-toothed. I did what I could, cobbled a rough shelter out of windfall, lit a hazy lamp, gave blood, tucked covers. I was limping myself, silent as an empty bell. In the moonlight through the window, I see my gray beard rise and fall with ancient syllables laying me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If she should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. Amen, amen, amen. As the poet Chase Twitchell says of these poems, they tell a thousand small secrets. We're inside the poet's mind as he wrestles with a complex yet perfectly normal life. You see how luminous it is to have such a life. That's the thing about poetry. If the poet can take us into that interior with no loading up of pretentious language or thoughts, we expand to fill the space. We are in that life. In the third section of the book, the children are grown, the grandchildren visit at their cottage, and there's a maybe more reflective quality. I want to read you part of this long one that carries the tone of the speaker in all of these tender poems. There's a word here you might not know. I had to look it up. It's called callipygian. It means having well-shaped buttocks. The mirror in Rome. In the mirror, you say, you see a worn woman, and that you've earned your worry lines and evidence of gravity's steady pull and enough money to erase them both with a modern sculptor's scalpel, if you choose. But when I look at you from behind my trifocals, over a white blizzard of beard that hides the cave of my few words, I see you standing as only you have stood before me. Your callipygian tilt the model for that famous sculpture now in Naples, your skin radiant as foxfire from the memory of four sublime babies now wandering like Aeneas this protean earth. No sculpture more beautiful than this. When I am laid to rest next to you in the glaciated soils of Minneapolis or Mackinac, we will have little to say to each other over that distance wide as the kitchen table, the stories of our lives written in what we did together, not the silences between. You'll finally sleep easily on your side of the plot, all ash and wind and water, a line of polished wisdom on your self-effacing stone. On my side, the heavy, messy snore of fungus and tree roots and moles' nests, a granite animal howling and scratching above me. I just wanted to give you that large chunk of that poem. So even in death, there's that amusing difference, the polished wisdom of the wife, the messy snore of the husband. There's been, he writes in another poem, all the life I can handle. We see it's been good, no matter what. I'm relieved to read poems in this climate, frankly, that don't avoid trouble, but that celebrate love and joy. I think this would be a good book to give as an anniversary present, actually. The poems are real, not sappy, and they're skillfully made. The poet is James Lynn Festi, and the book is A Marriage Book, 50 Years of Poems from a Marriage, from Milkweed Press, 2017.
Thank you, Fleta. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. My thanks to Lynn Ray Perkins, David Harris, Anne-Marie Oman, and Fleta Brown. Also, kudos to Daniel Wanshura and Gary Langley for the skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, this is Aaron Stander wishing you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.